Hey, back on downtown. Here on your Thursday afternoon, Rich Kimball with you. Our next guest on the program is written for Deadspin. He writes currently for Defector. He co-hosts the Distraction podcast with our friend David Roth. He's the author of books like The Hike and Someone Could Get Hurt. He's a Chopped champion, and he's also the author of a terrific new book chronicling what happened to him following a devastating brain injury. The book is called The Night the Lights Went Out. We are pleased to be joined this afternoon by Drew McGarry. Drew, thanks so much for being with us.
I know the music cue. I do appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, there's a story behind that. And well, let me give it to you. Can you, how would you summarize the events that happened to you 3 years ago this December?
I was at a work party in a karaoke bar. I sang You Got Lucky by Tom Petty. I walked out of the, it was a private room. I walked out to take a pee. And then I blacked out, and I woke up 2 weeks later. It turned out that I had suffered a brain hemorrhage in that hallway, collapsed, and fractured my skull in three places. I had gone permanently half-deaf in 1 year. I lost my sense of smell. I lost some of my sense of taste. It took me 3 weeks to learn how to walk again and get out of the hospital after I was in the coma for 2 weeks. And then I spent a year basically trying to figure out how to be a person again. And that is the story of the book, and here I am talking.
Well, the book is great, but I have to tell you, for a hypochondriac, boy, what a banquet of delights it is for me, because in reading it, every time I would get an ache or a pain over the couple of days of reading, I'm like, oh this is it, because my mom had a cerebral hemorrhage when she was 33. And it's interesting to me, we all, with life experience, we all understand cancer and heart attacks, we get that. But the brain is, in so many ways, still a complete mystery to us.
Yeah, I was, you know, because I'm in my 40s, so I was like, I better watch my cholesterol. You know, you always think about your heart and all that stuff. And yet here, you know, I suffer from this injury that is, you know, one of the leading killers in the United States. 1.5 million people get a traumatic brain injury every year. And, you know, it happens from people getting strokes. That's, I think, one of the main culprits, but from car accidents, from assaults and things like that. But, you know, there are 1.5 million of us, and we don't all die right when that happens. But you have to learn to live with it after the fact, and the people around you have to live with you after the fact. And that's its own story. And it plays out over and over and over again. If you did not suffer a TBI yourself, you certainly know someone who has, as you just told me, Rich. So it's a nearly universal American affliction. That frankly doesn't get a lot of run because either, you know, other stuff is just happens to get better awareness and happens to have better branding, or people don't care enough, and I'm going to try to get them to.
Now, is it safe to say that after you came out of your medically induced coma, you weren't exactly a model patient?
No, I was mad. Like, if you ever watch, like, Grey's Anatomy, and like someone takes like an arrow to the skull and they're like a totally different person. Like that's a very melodramatic example, but I had damaged my frontal cortex, which regulates emotion. So when I got up, you know, not only had I been in a medically induced coma and was still shaking off all the drugs to induce that coma, but I had brain damage that inhibited my ability to rein in my emotions at important times. So I was pissed. My wife said, you were a jackass. That was on the record, so that's in the book.
And you, I did enjoy the fact that they saw it as a good sign when you responded to the nurses at one point by flipping them off.
Yeah, they said, please show me a finger, and I showed them both fingers, and they were a special kind of finger. So it made my family weep because they knew that there was still, you know, still the same, naughty little boy was still in there.
We're talking with Drew McGarry on Downtown. His book is called The Night the Lights Went Out. I was at a conference. I teach school full-time, and we had a conference recently about dealing with trauma, and the person doing the presentation said, we think of trauma wrong, that it's not an event as much as it's our response to events. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it is, because, you know, if you watch movies and TV, the trauma always plays out along, it always comes instantly after the event or even during the event. You know, you watch a horror movie, someone screams, stuff like that. That's really not how real life plays out. If you've ever been scared or you've been through an emergency situation, you have a fight or flight response where you usually go stone silent and you just sort of get through it, and then the trauma happens. It's, you know, like I said in the book, it's a vine. It grows on and around you, around your mind, you know, over time. And it's not, you know, you think of trauma as an incident, and it's not. It's a process. It grows, and it's much in the same way recovery is a process. You know, the damage is not sudden necessarily, although in my case I had a lot of physical sudden damage. But the psychological damage, you know, only slowly begins to reveal itself the more you think about it and the more time you have to live after the event.
Was it when you realized that you had hearing loss that you felt like you had joined the disabled community?
Yeah, I thought so, because there were things I simply could not do. I was half deaf, and if you're half deaf or you have lots of hearing problems, your experience still has a cocktail party effect, where if you go into a loud room, you are not able to really discern between all the noises that you hear. If you're fully able with hearing, and, you know, a room can be loud, but you can still sort of make out the difference between, you know, one conversation going on over there and a waiter dropping a plate, you know, on the other corner of the room, and the band singing the song. All that morphs into a blur if you have hearing loss, and it prevents you from being able to do things without corrective equipment, as I have. I have hearing aids, and I have a cochlear implant. So, I knew that when I got the diagnosis, I knew that my life would never be the same, and at the time, I assumed that my life would always be worse, and that actually did not turn out to be the case, and I'm glad it did.
I love some of the science that's in the book, too, and I understood, and my wife works with people in the deaf and hard of hearing community, and the way the cochlear implant works, to me, is fascinating, and yours turned out to work very well. First of all, you don't know if it's going to work, but it did. But how it takes the sounds from the non-functioning ear and is able to sort of bounce those off the other, well, I can't explain it well, but can you tell us how it all works?
Yeah, so there is, it looks like, you know, not to be crass, but it looks like a boxy sperm. It's an electrode that they graft onto the outside of your skull. And it has a little tail, a little squiggly tail, with an area of electrodes lined on it. And they put that through a little hole in your skull and into the cochlea. The cochlea is on your inner ear. It's the organ that takes sound, interprets it, and sends it to your brain as the sounds that you hear. And, you know, when you have a destroyed inner ear, as I did, the outside sound does not reach the cochlea. So this bypasses the ear entirely. My current ear is basically ornamental, and I have a little, like, key fob that's stuck to my head that takes in sound and relays it to that electrode array that goes directly into the cochlea and then goes into my brain. So it's essentially a way of circumventing the human ear and replacing it, so I have a robot ear.
And while that process was taking place, and this is a common side effect, you lost your sense of taste.
I did, because when they operate on you, the nerve that controls your hearing is also linked to taste, and it got a little dinged when they were working around my skull when I got cochlear implant surgery, and I woke up and I couldn't taste anything, and that freaked me out because, you know, I had lost so much already, and food meant a lot to me, as it does now, and I thought, well, if it never comes back, I really, you know, I don't know how much lower I can get psychologically, and it came back mostly, but, you know, my palate is now, I'd say, working at about like 75 or 80% capacity, and we'll probably stay that way.
I like how you pointed out in the book, too, that those charts of the tongue and our taste buds that we all looked at when we were little kids, that's not really how the tongue and the taste system works.
That's right. That's garbage. So you got this map that said sweets in the front and like sour is on the sides and bitters in the back or something, or umami's in the center and all that stuff. All wrong. The tastes are all over your tongue. But, you know, the front of your tongue detects those things very quickly to determine whether or not something's poisonous or delicious, and then proceeds accordingly. But the map was devised by a German scientist, you know, essentially to sort of make it easy for kids to understand how the palate works. But it was all garbage, and they should never teach it again.
Drew McGarry with us here on Downtown. So you had this incredible experience. People have written and spoken about near-death experiences. For you, it was not particularly profound because you were gone.
I was gone. I was napping. It was quite pleasant because, you know, if you've ever gone to sleep, it's nice to be asleep and then wake up. And so I was in a coma for 2 weeks, and they took me out periodically because it was a medically induced coma. I have no memory of that. They would take me out of it. I would go Frankenstein and rip tubes out of my head and stuff like that. But I have no memory of that. I only remember the waking up part, and the time in between that was 2 weeks. It may as well have been 5 minutes. I really do not remember it. I had no visions. I didn't see anything. You know, I didn't see St. Peter or anything like that, even though my heart rate had gone down to 44 beats a minute and my lungs had failed. I didn't have any of those sensations. All I had was basically a sweet trip to the black, and it was fine. So it was not as romanticized as, you know, my average heavy metal daydream of what a coma was.
but it has certainly changed your outlook, and a couple of things you said that really hit me. One, you say that those who love you are your afterlife.
Yes, that's correct. I'm not a terribly religious person. I didn't really know that there would be heaven or hell or anything like that, but it became very evident to me that, you know, the way that you live on is through the relationships you forge here on the ground, and the people who carry that part of you in their spirit and becomes part of their spirit. And it goes on and on through generations, and it stays here through the world, and that's how you stay with the world.
And when you went back through and looked at some of the pictures and then read those narratives about what people saw, what they did, when you read your wife's Caring Bridge entries, and you realized, among other things, that there were a whole lot of people who loved you, and that's something to try and live up to.
Yeah, it's nice. It's nice to be loved, and it's nice to have people care that much. I wish that they had not had to go through that, but that is generally what I think about. I think about it as something that happened to them more than it happened to me, because I was asleep. I don't remember. And, you know, I had to deal with a lot of stuff after that, obviously, and I still deal with it to this day. But I was not awake for the scary parts, and they were. And I try to always remember that. And I try to always remember what they endured for my sake and why they did it. And I try to always be grateful for that. And I am. It makes me happy. And it's a bittersweet happiness because, obviously, like I said, I wish that they hadn't gone through it. And I don't wish adversity on anybody. But we all go through it. And it's always nice to know that love is in our corner when we do.
You thought you were doing pretty well in your recovery, but there were some issues, anger and frustration, and so eventually you made the decision to go to therapy, and you wrote of that, not all your thoughts were valuable, nor were they useful.
No, yeah, because I'm a writer, so I'm used to everything I write not only being important, but I get to broadcast it to the world, right? And, you know, I've been living that way for a very, very long time. And, you know, after I got hurt, it made me realize that there was a great value in keeping my thoughts to myself and letting other people have the floor, which I did not do anywhere near enough in my previous life. And I endeavor to do more of now, but I still have a lot of work to do in that regard. My wife will tell you that happily.
Now, you didn't make a bucket list, and I like this approach. You say that life is meant to be incomplete. You're not supposed to get to everything on that list.
No, because you can't, right? You're not going to be able to do everything. You're not going to be able to meet everybody. You're not going to be able to visit every country unless you're like Tony Bourdain or something like that. You're just not going to be able to do that, but that's sort of the beauty of it, right? There are no limits to what you can do. That, you know, if you, you know, it would be weird if you, like, did everything and you're like, well, I guess that's it for life. I guess I won. I guess that's how it works, right? So the idea is that there's always something new for you to experience and enjoy. And even once you've experienced all of those things, there's so much more that if you don't get to it, people you love or even people you don't know, they're going to get to enjoy those things. And that's really cool.
Like a lot of us, you outkicked your coverage when it comes to Sonia. My God, what a hero she comes through as in this story.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, you don't want to be the sort of wife guy who's like, oh, my wife's Satan, all that stuff. And I'm just a bastard and all that. But what she went through, you know, there was a lot of bravery that, you know, I remain, you know, deeply admiring of what my wife went through and how she was able to keep the family together through all of this. And I hope I hope that if anything happens to her, and God forbid it doesn't, that I will have learned from her strength to keep us together in the same way. That's all I can do, because she was a fantastic role model. And, you know, I will always be forever grateful and appreciative, and I'll always love her.
Do you miss anything about the old Drew?
No, I don't. No, I don't. I don't miss anything about it. Like, I want to tell you, I miss drinking, because I used to drink, but I don't drink anymore since I got hurt. But I don't even miss that. Like, I think maybe if I miss anything, it's going out more. But I can't really blame that on the injury. I can blame that on a little pandemic that's still going on around us. That tends to be the bigger culprit right now.
Tell me, Carter is still going strong, please.
Carter, my dog, is doing well. His eyesight's not fantastic, and sometimes he gets a little growly, but no, he's fine.
Glad to hear that, because I loved reading about him. Also, a big success story happened in your career after the demise of Deadspin, when you and David Roth and others went off and started your own thing, and who knew how that was going to go, but wow, Defector has just been a huge success.
It has. We got very, very, we were very, very fortunate. We launched during the pandemic in September of 2020 as a subscription site, because it was the only way we were going to be able to do it, to make the product good and not have 4 billion ads on the site and all that stuff. And, you know, we were, you know, it was, you know, times were tight for everybody. And so we were sort of hoping that the people that read us and enjoyed us when we were at Deadspin would follow us to this new site and be willing to pay, you know, it's not a huge amount, but you know, it's still money and it's still something that people think about. And, you know, I think a lot of people my age are still used to the idea of the internet being free and not really necessarily willing to adapt, in the same way that, you know, back when Napster was around, that, you know, people were used to music being free and not paying for streaming. But what happened was we launched and we got 10,000 people to subscribe right when we launched, and it's grown to 40,000, and we've all been able to be employed and have health insurance for ourselves and pay ourselves our salaries and even hire people. So it's been a really, really wonderful thing to have happen. And the nice thing is that it's a business. Like, you know, it's not just people signing up because, you know, they think of us as like a Kickstarter or something like that. It's because we're giving them stuff they want to read and they enjoy reading it without a lot of interference from advertising, without a lot of garbage comments, because we, you know, there's a level you got to pay above to get comments. So, you know, all of it has worked out really, really well, and we're just going to keep at it and keep giving people what they want.
Well, you mentioned insurance, and that's one of the messages in the book too, is how lucky you were to have insurance cover a lot of you went through. And I look at what we've all gone through in the pandemic, and I would hope it won't happen, of course, but I would hope politicians or anybody in charge would come through the last year and a half and say, health insurance should never be tied to anybody's job. Everybody should have it.
Yeah, you would think that they would realize that, but, you know, Kirsten Sinema's going to do what she's going to do.
Yeah. Have you come around on mayonnaise at all?
No, I still don't care for it. Sorry.
You're not missing much, I don't think. The book is great. The night the lights went out, it's a funny as hell, but also a uplifting and poignant read. Drew McGarry, been a fan of your work for such a long time. Glad to hear you're doing well, and really appreciate you making some time for us today.
Thank you for having me on, and I do apologize for being a little late. That will not happen again.
All right, we're okay. You get a free pass on the first one.
That's very, very fine. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you, Drew. Be well. Drew McGarry on Downtown. The book, again, is called The Night the Lights Went Out, and man, it is such a powerful read. Yeah.